I'm Mike Collins. The Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup is on the road this week. We'll be live from the HeroesCon Comic Book Convention at the Charlotte Convention Center. Grab your cape, your ray gun, your lightsaber, and stop by Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Costumed comic book characters will soon be roaming the streets of Uptown, and it won't be your imagination. It's HeroesCon, the annual convention, and we meet the creator of this 36-year-old event later in the program. We begin, though, with a different kind of make-believe, the kind you find at the movies. It's summer movie season, and here to tell us what you should or shouldn't see are two of Charlotte's leading longtime movie critics, Matt Brunson, who takes on that task for creating of Loafing, and Sean O'Connell, the managing director of CinemaBlend.com.
Good morning.
Good morning to both of you.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Good
Long
to see
time
you.
No see. Where have you been? Up to anything? Seen any good movies recently?
At the movies.
Now, perhaps it's my age, but I remember a time when I got excited about summer because of the movies. And I'm not really excited this year. I'm not hearing a lot of buzz about what's coming or what has already arrived. Am I imagining that? Am I just old?
I think there are some buzzy titles. There are some benchmark franchises. There's a new Star Wars movie in theaters. There's obviously a Marvel film. The Jurassic Park franchise is back. Nothing ever really goes away for very long. Hollywood finds a way of sort of...
But all of those movies you mentioned
yes.
were exciting when the first edition came out because it was something new
True.
And creative, and it pushed the boundaries of technical capabilities of film. Now we're on the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, eighth iteration of these films.
Right.
Is there nothing new? Nothing new ever, anywhere, anymore?
Every once in a while. But I think part of the problem, too, with the buzz and the hype and the big summer movie is now they're spreading this out throughout the year. I mean, it's no longer just a summer event.
Why?
I think they realize they actually can make money from other seasons. Who knew? But, you know, when you have Black Panther come out earlier in the year, and that was a gargantuan hit, and I think it just kind of diminishes. Plus, I think having, you know, you have your big July 4th movie, and when they had the Lone Ranger with Johnny Depp that one year, that kind of killed the summer event movie there.
Okay, and they, as you said, they're spreading these films out. So is there really a summer movie season? Because the movies that have been depicted this year as summer movies, some of them were released in April.
Yeah, you're right. There used to be a real anticipation around not just the summer season, but these holidays built inside the summer. Memorial Day weekend was always a big one for a release, July 4th. And I think that those windows have lost some of their impact. There are still big movies opening on those weekends, but because, as Matt was saying, the audiences are trained to go see a blockbuster almost every other week now, and then also because like those movies used to sort of cannibalize themselves. Like you'd get 1 week at the box office, and then the next massive movie was coming right behind it.
Right.
Now some of the studios are looking to position their blockbusters so that they have 2 to 3 weeks of no competition. So it's like the Avengers opened at the beginning of May, and then nothing really opened. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's right, April 27th. And then nothing really opened around it. They all sort of try to avoid each other. The thing is, they're all Disney. So Disney's trying to just not compete
Broadway.
With themselves.
So is Broadway.
Yeah, that's true.
The world is Disney because it's owned by Disney,
yes.
Inc. USA, Disney, Inc. one of the films that would be classified as a summer film that did come out in April, Avengers Infinity War. Can you consider that a summer film then? Or are we just saying that really...
Oh.
You guys need to come back every week or so to talk about the new season of movies.
Basically, we're free next week, I think.
No, that's a summer movie. I mean, by every definition, that's a summer movie. Yes, it opened a week earlier, and that's been happening over the past few years, too.
Oh, yeah, past decade or so. It used to be, June was summer movies, and it became May, then it was mid-May, then it became first week in May. That's been the big one for a while. And now with Avengers Infinity War, they said, well, let's just scoot it a week up in April.
Yeah,
maybe nobody will notice.
And this film, the Avengers Infinity War, it spans the entire Marvel universe in what they call an ultimate showdown. What's your take on the result?
Oh, I loved it. But I'm really dialed into what Marvel Studios is doing. I like that whole Marvel Cinematic Universe. I grew up reading those comics. It's great that you're going to have Shelton in later at the end of the show because this is his time to shine. All of these characters that he's been beating the drum for, oh gosh, no pun intended, that was really horrible. are now, you know, the main stars in Hollywood. It's not like an actor or an actress can't open a movie anymore. But a character can. Like, Black Panther will crush at the box office, but Tom Hanks can't get people to go buy tickets.
What does that tell you about where we are as a culture today? An actor or an actress can't do this anymore?
I don't know. That's a really good question, and I'm sure that that's what a lot of Hollywood studios are trying to figure out. Like, how come we can't put Russell Crowe on a poster anymore and open a movie to 20 million?
Is it because there are just too many options? Too many films, too many television shows,
that's
too many other
it.
Alternative things.
That's a lot of it. There's so much on TV now with cable TV. And a lot of
movie stars have gravitated towards HBO and Showtime and Hulu and places like that.
Can you think of anybody who can open a movie?
Well, I was going to say, there's certain actors still within a certain franchise who can open it. Like, Tom Cruise is pretty much guaranteed to make a lot with the Mission Impossible, not with The Mummy. So there's still some of the really big stars, but, you know, they're going to have a hit with every, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, I miss with every five hits or so.
Sure.
So another comic book film, Deadpool 2, came out in May, and a lot of parents, I would imagine, stumbled into the first Deadpool movie with their kids in tow and were aghast at what they saw. And I know that Deadpool 2 is no different. This does star Ryan Reynolds as a superhero who breaks the mold in every way. And the first one was funny because, to me at least, it was funny because of the shock value. How is this?
I thought it really held up. I think the first movie to them was a test balloon of how far can we push the envelope. And when the audience responded the way that you did, they were like, oh, a lot of people like this. Let's go even harder into it. And to me, it was extremely funny. Now, the thing about Deadpool, even the first movie, and I haven't gone back to see the second one, I laughed, you know, from start to finish in the second one. But I think that the repeat value on those films isn't really quite what it should be, because it's all about the shock. It's all about, like, how far are they going to go in this scene, and the one-liners that just sort of catch you off guard. So I don't know how it plays on repeat value.
Yeah, it was. I'd say almost as much fun as the first one. It's definitely more of the same. I think this one they tried to add a little more. And they always do this with movies. No matter how shocking and edgy, they always try to add a sentimental edge. Yeah. And this one is the whole unity of family. And that's not what we go to Deadpool for. I thought that kind of went against the grain. Other than that, I enjoyed it.
In your review of it, you said that the best part of the film happens after the credits roll.
Yeah,
and the worst thing that happens before the movie even starts. What about the middle?
You know, it's the
actual movie.
Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you know, a little.
What happens at the end? Or would that just.
Oh, no,
ruin?
It would
that
be
would
a spoiler.
It?
Yeah.
So you have to stay through the credits.
Who doesn't in a Marvel?
All of these comic book movies, they put scenes in the end credits. So the fans have sort of been conditioned to stay and see where the story's going to go. And Deadpool takes that idea and twists it in ways
it more than outtakes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not
it's a lot more than outtakes. And what I love about that, too, is, like, Ryan Reynolds is just so perfect. Like, when they cast him as Deadpool, his humor, the sarcastic humor, it just fits that character beautifully.
Will there be a Deadpool 3?
They want to do an X-Force movie, which is a team that Deadpool was on that Josh Brolin's having the summer of his life. He was Thanos, the villain in Infinity War. He's Cable in Deadpool 2. He has a Sicario sequel coming out for adults, for grown-ups. So, yeah, he's having a great... And so he and Ryan Reynolds will do an X-Force movie, which I think is coming out at the end of next year.
Okay. So let's move from the comic books to a different franchise, another major movie franchise, Star Wars. This one, Solo, a Star Wars story, in case you were wondering who Solo was. It brought in over $83 million in its first weekend, but evidently that's not enough for a Star Wars film. In the New York Times review, the first sentence reads, "Star Wars just fell to earth."
Oof.
Bad film or just bad luck?
It's not a bad film, so I think it's bad luck. This is the story that fascinates me above several others this season, is Star Wars fatigue and whether it's an actual thing. Matt's shaking his head. He doesn't believe that it's a thing. But we're 6 months after Star Wars The Last Jedi, which is a movie that the fan base is pretty split on. There's a lot of people who just didn't really like it. But I also just think, like, 6 months after, it's what we were talking about at the beginning of the summer blockbuster season. When every weekend has a blockbuster, then blockbusters aren't special anymore.
I agree they should have waited more than 6 months. But at the same time, I think it's more about this is the one of the most iconic characters in Star Wars. Sure. Who wants to see anybody but Harrison Ford in this role? And Alden Ehrenreich does a pretty good job, but he's not Harrison Ford.
But is he a young?
He's the
Han Solo.
It's supposed to be, you know, his early adventures.
So it'd be kind of hard to do with Harrison.
That creepy digital stuff to make him young, which would not have worked. No, this is one I don't think they should have made.
Well, frankly. And I'll argue, I thought he did a really good job. He's not the reason that I didn't really care for this movie.
He did a fine job, but I'd never, you know, like with Ewan McGregor, I believed he was Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan. I never believed this guy became Harrison Ford as Han Solo.
They did something too behind the scenes, and this is inside baseball, but a big enough story that people know it. They hired these two comedian directors, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who did the Lego Movie, and they did the 21 Jump Street reboot. So they take these on paper bad concepts and they inject some surreal humor into them. And these guys started filming a Han Solo movie. And I was, and I think a lot of other people were excited to see what those two guys would do with a young Han Solo movie.
And then they got fired?
Then they got fired.
Yeah, because they were going too far. They were going Deadpool, basically, I think. Deadpool Solo.
So they get replaced by Ron Howard, who is completely competent, but a very safe choice to deliver a generic...
Yeah.
Enjoyable, you know, but not really boundary pushing Han Solo movie.
So, Matt, you say hips don't lie, swagger is missing from this movie. Is that because Opie directed it?
I think that has a lot to do with it, yes.
Really?
Yeah, I think, like he was saying, he's more of a safe choice or wasn't just as much of a...
Let's get back to the Star Wars fatigue, because there are all these Star Wars movies in the catalog, and there are 9 Star Wars movies in the works. The next one is scheduled for December 2019. When you have a franchise like Star Wars or Star Trek or even James Bond, can you expect, should you expect, that every single movie in the series is going to be great?
No. But what I would like to see out of them is more risks. Take more chances. Like, they're always going to be Star Wars movies, right? Like, we're going to have one every year for the foreseeable future. But hire some directors and trust their process, you know, to make bold decisions and let them do it. You know, let them swing for the fences. When people
who owns Star Wars?
Disney.
Of course.
Disney does. Yeah. Disney bought Lucasfilm. But, you know, someone always says, like, how come we don't get upset when we see 3 Marvel movies in a year? And it's because Marvel Studios hires not groundbreaking directors, but directors with really strong vision and lets them do what they want to do. So you get a Black Panther movie that's totally different from a Thor movie. Like, we had a Thor slapstick comedy recently, and it worked. It was funny, and I want to see Star Wars do that.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation, we only about a minute and a half here, but the new Jurassic Park movie, which is going to be called Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Hollywood, I understand, is expecting this to revitalize summer films. What have you heard? Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it. We see it next week. But again, the main reason I'm excited about it is the director. His name is J.A. Bayona. He did A Monster Calls, and he did a movie called The Impossible. And he reminds me of Spielberg. I think he's a really exciting director, and I want to see what he does. Yeah, no, I think his movies remind me of the type of film Spielberg made.
I've seen the trailer, and I'm thinking, gosh. How many more of these things where the dinosaurs get out of control and eat people and the world is suddenly saved by a scientist who sees
Jeff
Goldblum? How many of these do we need? Aren't they just recycling the same story?
I wasn't the biggest fan of Jurassic World, so don't ask me.
But it made over $1 billion.
I know, that's why we're getting this one.
I know.
So. I mean, do you think this will add something to the story at all?
Oh, all I will say is that I've heard there's a third act plot twist that sets up the next one.
Of course.
That Deadpool sounds shows up, I think.
We talk about a reboot of a female reboot of a franchise when we come back in a moment with Matt Brunson and Sean O'Connell on WFAE Charlotte Talks.
You have a voice, but what if you felt like it wasn't being heard? She Says, WFAE's new investigative podcast is available now. Hear the first episode on WFAE.org/She Says.
It's Charlotte Talks, and our trek into fantasy land here as we talk about summer movies first, and later on the Comic Con convention, or the Heroes Con convention, excuse me, which is based on comic books. Shelton Drum is here. He'll be here shortly from Heroes Aren't Hard to Find to talk about that 36-year-old convention. We're talking right now to Matt Brunson, who is the film reviewer for Creative Loafing, and Sean O'Connell, managing director of CinemaBlend.com, which is all about films online. Let's talk about the fact that summer blockbusters used to be bang bang, shoot 'em up, let's blow as much stuff up as we possibly can, and it appealed to 13-year-old boys, and it starred men. Well, now we have a reboot of a franchise which is starring all women, and I'm talking about Ocean's 8. It's supposedly the biggest title of all these new movies with women in the lead, with Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling, Sarah Paulson, Rihanna, Helena Bonham Carter. How did they get together in the same film? Among others, heading up the cast. There was negative reaction to the all-female Ghostbusters. What has been the reaction to this? Because this goes back to the Rat Pack.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the reaction has been as strong. I mean, that whole Ghostbusters thing was ridiculous in itself anyway. And I think on this one, since it's not... I mean, Ghostbusters was a beloved franchise within itself, whereas...
Beloved by whom?
Well, like boys who grew up in the 80s, and that's why they objected to the all-female casting. But this is more, you know, it's more spread out. You had the Rat Pack version. You had George Clooney's three movies. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was as much beyond the box office potential. I don't think there was as much to ruffle idiotic feathers.
Yes, but your headline for your review of this in Creative Loafing is Ocean's 8 is enough.
Mm-hmm. It's like all of them. It's no better or worse than the thank you. It's no better or worse than the Clooney ones. To me, this whole series has basically been, hey, we have studios giving us money. You guys want to go to Europe or Vegas and party, and we'll just film a few scenes while we're, you know, hitting the slots. And to me, this is more the same. It's a lot of likable actors. You know, nothing really of consequence happens, but it's not a bad movie.
I mean, if you go back to the Rat Pack, which for people who are not alive, have not been alive long enough to know who that is, that's Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Joey Bishop and people like that, and then the reboot of that or those original movies with George Clooney and others. How does this compare? In other words, can women? These are suave, debonair guys who are on the surface. People you'd like to know, but they're crooks. How does that work with women?
I mean, this movie is not lacking star power. The women are still
they're great.
They're still great. There's still really good chemistry in the cast. Anne Hathaway it really uses the belief that people have that she is this sort of, you know, aloof A-lister to her advantage to play a sort of famous person in the movie. They tweak that. The thing that annoys me about this movie is that the heist itself is really dumb. Like, if you just question any aspect of it, it falls apart. And it's not that the Clooney ones were airtight at all, but they tried hard to at least make the heist stand on its own. And this one, to me, was so disappointing because, yes, there's an element of going to watch these celebrities, whether they're male or female, just have fun with a concept. But you still go to a heist movie, and you want the heist to sort of...
Well, at least have complications. And this one just goes so smoothly. It's just like...
It really does, yeah.
Why don't we all go out and rob people? It's that easy.
And there's a lot of like little elements that should be explained in the heist. And I was constantly in the movie being like, wait a second. Can you just... how did that happen? Like, suddenly they all have jobs at the Met where they're supposed to be robbing. And I was like, they would never... You wouldn't get hired.
They cut that scene for time.
I guess. But, you know, Steven Soderbergh directed the three with Clooney and Pitt and Damon, and he has a style, and Gary Ross tried to, you know, ape that style, and it just didn't feel like its own thing. So
Why didn't they just hire Soderbergh?
He's too busy in television, which we like discussing.
He did produce it, though, so
yeah.
He did give it his blessing.
All right, going back to May, because that's when summer begins now, evidently, Life of the Party, which starred Melissa McCarthy, and Book Club, which starred Diane Keaton, Candace Bergen, Jane Fonda, and Mary Steenburgen, once again, women, but they didn't exist. None of these films set the world on fire. Talk about them.
To me, these are counter-programming, and this goes to show, like, we sometimes badmouth the blockbusters, but the blockbusters are what people want to go see. And so these other studios sort of step up and offer an alternative. But when the blockbusters are attracting so much attention and so many eyeballs, it's really hard for something like Book Club, which I've heard, I didn't see, but I've heard is actually enjoyable. I did see Life of the Party, that is not good. And so I would gladly send people to, you know, Solo or Deadpool 2. The counter programming has to be good.
To be fair, though, with Book Club, they are considering that a success because it's, it has legs, as they say in the industry. It's holding on week to week. They weren't expecting a, you know, $200 million opening for this. Right. But as he said, as counter programming, it's actually turning a little profit.
So, Book Club, Diane Keaton plays a divorcee or a divorced woman? And
she's a widow.
Widow, then, excuse me.
And yeah, it's just.
And it's her pals.
Yes, basically. And the book club is just the hook to hang right. on them getting together and talking about going out. And because the book they pick to read is 50 Shades of Grey, so it gets them all excited to go out and date. So it's one of those that it's cute that if they weren't in it, you probably wouldn't watch it. But they're always so great to watch. But you wish they'd get those four together for like some big Oscar caliber movie.
Put them in
so
the Oceans good. Movie. I'd watch that cast in Ocean's 8 and it would be better.
Are you serious?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I just think they'd be more fun to watch interacting with each other.
Well,
Mary Steenburgen's fantastic in everything.
Of course. If women getting together and having misadventures isn't working for you, how should we look at Tag? This stars Jeremy Renner, John Hamm, Ed Helms, and others, and sounds to me just like Hangover. In this case, a group of five highly competitive friends reunite for 1 month a year for a no-holds-barred game of tag that they've been playing since the first grade. Little boys, grown up, doing what little boys do.
Go ahead.
No comment, Matt?
No. actually, I preferred it much to The Hangover. It's not great, but it has a lot of laughs, and it's based on a true story, and that's
really?
The amazing part. That's why they decide to do it.
So adults get together and play tag?
Mm-hmm.
For 1 month.
And it's one of those
for
at the end.
For a month? How do you play tag for a month?
Well, you know, this is a movie. So we just saw this last night, and it is a movie that's sort of like, for the opening half hour, as it's setting the stage for what these guys are going to do, they do hop all over the country, like with no real explanation about this. I think they visit four different cities in the first 20 minutes, and no one changes an outfit. when they all end up in Portland and they're wearing the same clothes at the start. Like, there is a joke where Jake Johnson, who is a standout in this movie, they're saying, get in the car. We got to go. We're going to head to Portland, grab a bag. And he goes, nope, I'm good to go. And he just hops in the car.
That explains wardrobe, doesn't it?
But there is the rules of this concept in this movie hold together in ways I never thought. Like, you can't tag back the person who tagged you. Mm-hmm. They're always, throughout the movie, acknowledging who was the last person tagged and who is it. And that becomes a running joke.
And they show the real people at the end and then credits, which is always fun to see them doing their own. They were filming it so that you see them doing tag and the shower and stuff. And it's pretty
and
fun.
I want to point out, too, the Jeremy Renner. So Jeremy Renner is the character in the group who has never been tagged
in 30 years.
So it's all about the other guys in the group trying to get him, and it's his wedding weekend. But and I paid attention to this last night. He fell and broke both arms on day 3 or 4 of the production, of the filming of this production. And he has a very physical role.
Wow.
So his arms in this movie, if you go see it this weekend, and you should because it's very funny, his arms are CGI for the entire movie because he's wearing full arm casts and they had to put green screen sleeves over his arms. This is a guy who plays Hawkeye in the Marvel movies and has never gotten hurt on set and he's in a tag movie and he falls. It's the scene where they have him trapped in the AA meeting and he's on top of that row of chairs and he goes down and lands. Well, when he went down and landed, he landed on his arms and broke both of them.
Ooh,
So everything else he shot from that point on is CGI arms. And you can't tell. You can't tell. There's specifically a scene where he's throwing donuts at Ed Helms' face, and those are CGI arms.
Now you see,
attached to Jeremy Renner.
We go back then to the Solo movie, Han Solo movie, Star Wars. They could have CGI'd the young Harrison Ford because they now have they now have this software
that
will allow you to put words in people's mouth and it looks like they're actually saying them. So you could go back and lift his head out of an old Star Wars movie and stick it in the new Star Wars movie and have him say whatever you want.
It doesn't look right. They tried it in Rogue One. They had Peter Cushing come back and it recreated his character and it just looks
creepy.
Yeah, it's not right yet.
Yeah.
It's close, but if you had young Harrison Ford in that Solo movie, it would be
if they're CGI-ing
disturbing.
The arms, and you bought it 100%, right? You don't notice.
100%. I could not see the seams on Jeremy Renner's arms.
It's amazing.
But you know what I love about Tag? Is that Tag is the original idea that you've been looking for. It's still an A-list cast, but if this isn't a remake of something, it's someone read this article in the Wall Street Journal and decided to turn it into a movie and cast it well. The cast has great chemistry. And,
All right. You
know, there are one-offs that aren't tied to huge signature brands.
All right. Adrift opened earlier this month. Did it open in June?
May.
May, okay. Film based on a true story of two sailors who set out to journey across the ocean from Tahiti to San Diego, but who instead sail into one of the most disastrous hurricanes in recorded history. It's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
70% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It's a love story and a survival drama. Did you like it?
I did. Yeah, it was surprisingly good. Better than I thought it was going to be. And it's one of those movies that opens in the middle of the survival. The storm has already hit. The boat has been wrecked. And Shailene Woodley is essentially waking up in the middle of her sinking ship. And you're riveted by how is she going to survive this situation. And then the movie does the
flashbacks
6 months
which
earlier.
Which to me kind of hurt it a bit.
It did.
Because I think if it had gone straight forward, it would have been a lot more suspenseful.
Really?
I liked it overall, but I think a straight story would have been better than you're really into this tense moment, and then it cuts back to them,
Agreed. You
know, eating.
Although sometimes I needed a break from the tension of her survival story. But you're right. Every time that they did flashback to this, you know, beautiful looking couple,
and isn't he
cute meeting?
Isn't he severely injured? Or when?
Yes, for a while he's missing, and then she finds him, and then yes, he's severely injured and can't really help. So it's very much her show.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, wow. She's great.
Okay, if you're looking to be scared, I'm told, by something like a horror film.
Hereditary.
Hereditary.
Yes.
Ooh, look at you.
Yes.
Look at you get excited here. It's the film to see. It deals with terrifying family secrets and a sinister fate. You gave it 3 out of 4 stars, Matt. You say that Toni Collette delivers a bravura performance, and you add that the movie contains moments of shocking brutality and gore. Sean, you say this film is scary in an unconventional way. It unnerves you, and you add the final act is an assault, and you say it messes with your perception. Well, you guys are really into this film.
Yes, and mainly for Toni Collette, who is incredible, and not that we didn't know this, but it's nice to be reminded every once in a while that when people let her really go full bore, she's incredible. This movie is getting compared to The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby.
Whoa.
And I don't think those comparisons are that far off. I really, really like. Now, I need to go back and see it a second time because it's one of those movies where you're never 100% sure what's happening until it reveals all of its cards. So now that I know what the reveal is, I want to sort of go back and see how many clues this director has peppered through. But he's a first-time writer-director.
That's amazing, Bart. It's his first movie. And I wouldn't go that far with the Exorcist comparisons, but I did quite enjoy it. I think there's a bit of a problem with the ending, which felt a little rushed and not quite all there. But
I agree with that.
But yeah, it's a good watch.
Well, but both The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby are really old movies now, but I remember being in the theater when they opened,
right. And
they were groundbreaking at the time.
Well, and this isn't
scary,
like
scary,
a,
scary stuff.
This isn't a jump scare type movie. Right. Like, it really is just you're unnerved by the really disturbing things that are happening in them. And I do agree with Matt. The resolution is kind of hurried, but yeah, it's creepy.
Another serious film, not the time of year for serious films, but necessarily, but you reviewed, Matt, a Paul Schrader film starring Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. Is that how you say her name? Seyfried? She used to be in Big Love on television.
Siegfried and Roy.
There's no G. The movie's called First Reformed. You gave it 3.5 stars. It deals with violence and religion
mm-hmm.
in the same unit, separate.
Both. Paul Schrader, who's written the scripts for movies like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and he had a religious background, a Calvinist, and he's always been fascinated with violence and religion. And this movie, in a way, is kind of a culmination of all his work over the decades. And it's one of those that's just not, it's never going to break out. It's just in a few hundred mm-hmm. theaters. But, you know, for anybody who wants real summer counter programming, this would be the one to see.
Amanda Seyfried is also in another film this summer, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. What an appropriate title for a film, because not only is it a lyric from ABBA, but I've seen the trailer. It's the same music, the same setting, apparently the same story, the same stars, Amanda Seyfried, Meryl Streep, Pierce Brosnan, Colin Firth, Julie Walters, Christine Baranski, and this time, Cher.
Yes.
Aside from Cher, what's different?
Nothing. Nothing. Which is why it has that exasperated subtitle.
Yeah,
you can actually hear the slumping shoulders of producers who are saying, is it here we go again.
It's not tongue-in-cheek, it's a finger.
Kind of. Yeah, did the first movie make money?
Oh, yeah.
Did it really?
Of course,
money.
It's
no
ABBA. Yeah.
It was like England's number one or two movie for a while. It was
really
huge.
Shame on those people.
This one is, it's flashbacks because they're like, we can't really move the story forward.
No.
So let's show Meryl Streep's character as a young woman and how she met these three men.
And we were having the debate when we watched the trailer in the theater the other day, if any of the Meryl Streep footage is new or if it's just recycled from the first movie.
Ah.
Oh, yeah. My wife kept going, you know, is Meryl going to be in this movie? And I thought she was, but at the end it just says, and Meryl Streep,
yeah.
Which basically means $10 million to come in and film 10 minutes, I think.
And again, kind of like with the Ocean's movies, like they film probably in Greece, you know, on this beautiful island. So it's an excuse for stars like Colin Firth and Pierce Brosnan to escape.
I wish I were in it. I would love to.
Okay, so we have 90 seconds. The Incredibles 2 comes 14 years after the first film. As you mentioned in your column on this, Matt, in that time, fans of the original film may have moved on. So what are your thoughts here?
It's a lot of fun. It doesn't have the depth of the original, but it's a good time.
Yeah.
That's it? That's all you have to say?
So 90 seconds. I wanted
okay,
to make sure
okay,
we got
well,
it.
And we do need to talk about, for a moment at least, about Mission Impossible Fallout. This is the sixth film in which Tom Cruise will play Ethan Hunt and in which he continues to do his own stunts, this time skydiving and something else. I did the skydiving scene in one take. Does he?
No, hundreds of takes.
Right.
He had to jump hundreds of times for them to get this
shot. Does
he have
a death wish? What's up with Tom?
No, he's invulnerable. I truly believe he's an immortal and that he will not be satisfied until he dies on camera. And then one summer, we will all go see a movie called The Death of Tom Cruise. And I will pay top dollar to see that movie. To see that movie. Because he delivers every single time.
Right, in 10 seconds, is our movie you're looking forward to?
No, go see Upgrade. Go see Upgrade
Spike
at Regal
Lee's
Stonecrest.
Black Klansman.
Oh, yeah, that trailer looks really good. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Matt Brunson from Creative Living, Sean O'Connell from CinemaBlend.com. Speaking of upgrades, Sheldon Drum will be here in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. On Friday, the Charlotte Convention Center will play host to Heroes Con. It's the 36th annual comic book convention created by Shelton Drum, owner of the comic book store Heroes Aren't Hard to Find. And every year, about 50,000 people attend this convention, and many come in costume. That's why you will be seeing a lot of Batman and Robins or Superman or Superwomen and other characters roaming the streets of Uptown Charlotte because they're going to and from the convention. And that's, in fact, why we're going to be doing the news roundup at the convention center, out front of the convention center. They won't let us inside because we'll be in our own costumes and they don't want us to mingle with those people. Anyway, that's it Friday at 9, and you're invited to be part of it. You're here to tell us more about this growing convention and is the aforementioned Shelton Drum. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. And I'm keeping Matt Brunson here because he's really interested into this.
Oh,
in
yeah.
this. And you just feel free to jump
I've
in.
I've known him for centuries, so I thought I'd hang around.
Okay. Where did the idea...
Kind of go hand in hand, comics and movies right now.
Exactly. Where did the idea for a comic book convention or a Heroes, because this is different from Comic-Con. Where did it come from, the idea for this?
Well, I did the first one in 1982. It was actually just an evolution and extension from the one-day mini cons I was doing starting in 77 mm-hmm. out at Eastland Mall when it was brand new.
Yeah.
But it was really just a time for collectors to get together and buy and trade and, you know, sell their books and maybe meet a comic artist or a writer. We did those for a few years, and I wanted to do something a little bigger after I'd opened my store and promote the industry and what we were doing. And that first year in 82, we maybe had 500 or 600 people. I think I had six maybe pro artists, and it's just grown every year since then.
Is this something the artists want to do? They want to go out there and meet the fans? Sometimes I know they sell signed panels and things like that.
Most of them do. You know, they do appreciate their fans. They're like anybody working in a creative industry. They've got work to do at home, so it's kind of hard to break away sometimes. But, you know, they do make money, too. The artists have originals to sell. They will do commissions. Some of them are now charging for autographs. So, yeah, there's ways for them to make money, too.
There are other similar conventions around the country that deal with superheroes, you and the kind you'll find in comics and movies and video games. Yours focuses exclusively on comic books and comic book characters. Why?
That's what I like.
Okay.
It's pretty, and you're the boss. It's a pretty selfish thing. You know, that's just kind of the way it started for me. We've had a few, you know, actors over the years, but usually they were here on behalf of some other vendor or studio or something.
So Marvel hasn't asked you to bring in actors from their films if you want to participate? If they want you,
they
want
haven't, to no. But, you know, I feel like trying to keep the attention on the source material is important for our industry.
Are you one of the there are lots of producers of these shows around the country. Are you one of the few producers of these shows who does it because this is your thing? You love these characters and these comic books as opposed to just this is a way to make money.
Well, yeah, I like to think that. I mean, that is true about me. There are so many shows in the country. I wouldn't say I'm the only one who likes comic books who's promoting a show, but there are quite a few corporations who are into it now that you know, they're multinational corporations that do all kinds of conventions all over the world. They're doing it for money. Huge shows.
Yeah.
New York, San Diego, Chicago, Dallas, places like that. But I think we are the second oldest continuously running show in the country behind San Diego.
Wow.
We probably are the biggest comic book focused convention in the country. We probably have more comic artists in attendance than any other one show that are comic book
people. That's saying a lot. Let's talk about you for a second, Shelton Drum, because you've been fascinated with comic books and characters since you were a child, and you started your comic book store, I think, in 1980. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
When you were 26 years old, after selling comics in flea markets. So that wasn't a new thing for you, selling comic books. What do you think your initial attraction to comic books was, and how have you maintained it? Why have you maintained it over the years? A lot of us, I was always at, what was it, I can't even remember the drugstore we used to buy comics at, but every single time a Superman came out or every single time a Batman came out, I was there ready to give my 10 cents over for this comic book
right.
The day it came out. But then that stopped for me. It didn't stop for you.
Well, I like to think I'm an artistic kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I used to draw a lot, took art lessons as a kid, and my sister is an artist, and so I was initially interested in art, I think. You know, I picked up comics as a little kid, and what really attracted me, what kept me, was the art. And I was like you. I was at the city pharmacy in Newton. They came in on Tuesdays and Fridays, so I was there after school. I was there so much that they just didn't unpack their magazines until I got there after school, and I would, you know, break them open, check them all in, and put them on the rack and get the ones I wanted. But, you know, I really thought for most of my junior high and high school years I was going to be a comic artist.
Wow.
I didn't realize how hard it was.
Yeah.
But I love the medium so much that I was just destined to stay in it some way.
And I read that at some point in time, you, I think it was in 1960, you were looking for comic books and you discovered that Amazing Spider-Man, number one, the first edition, was selling for $10 and that something was up if it was selling for 10 bucks, that there was money to be made here. They were going to gain value. How much would that Amazing Spider-Man, number one comic book be worth today?
Well, it depends on the grade, but let's assume it was... a very fine condition book, a pretty nicely maintained comic. It would be worth about $50,000.
Oh, my Lord. Really?
Yeah.
So how many of those do you have? And what vault are they in? So what goes on at Heroes Con? If people have never been or might be intimidated because they do see these people walking down the street looking like they popped out of the pages of a comic book.
Right.
And I'm dressed like this. So would I feel comfortable amongst those people?
Absolutely. Okay. You know, we do have a lot of cosplay going on, a lot of costumers, but in reality it's only about 5, maybe at the most 10% of the people who attend are dressed up. You know, most people are there looking for things to buy, comics to complete runs in their collection, or that special comic they want to get and get signed by an artist, maybe some toys that are, you know, related to comics, or apparel, or the original art from the artists. There are a lot of things to buy. I like to emphasize that. It is a trade show, or like a consumer show. But you don't have to go there to buy. You can just go there and absorb the excitement, because there are costume characters running around. You can ask them to, you know, take a photograph with them, and they're almost always ready to oblige. We have a costume contest on Sunday. That's the big day for costumes. But there's a programming track on, you know, how to make costumes or certain aspects of that. We've got programming tracks with interviews with the artists and writers, and we've got some intellectuals there talking about comics and education. And, you know, we've got a lot going on besides just comic books on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about, what did you call them, tracks?
Like programming tracks.
Yeah, well, they're
running
seminars. They're like seminars.
Seminars, yes.
Yeah.
Interviews. Workshops, seminars.
And I'm trying to find what I wrote down a couple of these because I thought, that, well, that's interesting, but I can't find it now, of course. we'll come back to that later. You're also auctioning off comic book art, including a rare sketch by one of my favorite, all-time favorite people, Bill Watterson.
He's everybody's favorite.
Calvin and Hobbes fame. I'm told he rarely draws anymore. He's a reclusive. He never comes out. Has all of that combined to make this sketch that you're auctioning off more valuable?
Well, yes. He's famous for not licensing his stuff,
right,
for one thing. I mean, if you don't read it as a comic strip, you're probably not going to. It's not legal. Mm-hmm. he has never sold his originals. He has given some away, so there have been a few that make it to the market, and they've gone for astronomical prices. He doesn't make personal appearances.
What's up with that? I mean, seriously, why wouldn't you license your stuff? Why aren't there Calvin and Hobbes coffee cups and hats and T-shirts and all kinds of stuff, particularly when it was in the newspaper and hot as a pistol?
Maybe he just made enough money with the strip. I don't know. I've never talked to him.
Well, how did you get this rare sketch?
Well, this sketch is on a Calvin Hobbes hardcover complete edition. So it's a signed and remarked book where he did a sketch of Calvin and Hobbes, which is pretty rare for him to draw those characters for public consumption anymore. I'm sure he draws all the time, and he does a lot of painting, I understand. He's a fantastic artist, still is. But, you know, he's not out there doing it day to day.
The grind.
But how we got this is it's going to be a benefit for Team Cul-de-Sac. And Team Cul-de-Sac is a benefit in honor of Richard Thompson. He did Cul-de-Sac the Strip.
Okay.
And Bill Watterson was a big fan of Cul-de-Sac the Strip, and he became friends with Richard. Richard passed away of Parkinson's disease, I think, 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. But he was a guest at Heroes Con 10 or 12 years ago, and he was a semi-regular. When he was diagnosed with that, we had an event on a Friday night called Drink and Draw, and artists would just sit and, you know, relax and have a drink and draw sketches on coasters and napkins and paper and stuff, and we'd auction them off and gave that money to a charity that he had started that donated that money to the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. So this is a benefit, and that's how we got it.
You run one of the most successful comic book stores in the country. Heroes aren't hard to find. Did that reputation help you in establishing both the convention and attracting not just the 50,000 people who come every year, but the artists and others who willingly come and participate in seminars and sign autographs and things like that?
Yes. I think the convention helped the store as much as the store certainly helped the convention. I was lucky enough to meet some professionals early on that supported me, and they had a good time here, and they would tell other pros that, yeah, this is a good place to go.
Yeah,
they'll take care of you. You'll have fun. And it's just been a blessing, really, that it's worked out the way that I guess I had hoped that the convention would promote the store and vice versa.
You know, we have this T-shirt here at FAE where you can, for a small membership donation, you can become a public radio nerd and own the T-shirt. And it used to be that comic books were part of nerd culture as well. The nerds are coming out of the closet and waving their flag proudly. you've said that kids used to get beat up for liking stuff like this, and now it's mainstream. Hollywood, Matt Brunson, has embraced this whole culture like almost nothing else in the whole world. Why has this transition occurred? Why is this suddenly so popular?
Our secret is out.
Yeah.
This stuff's good. These stories are good. Comics have always been entertaining. Comics got a bad reputation in the mid-50s.
Really? Why?
Well, they were a little risque then and a little gross and scary. And there were some things going on in the mid-50s. There were a lot of horror books and sexually provocative kind of things. And the Comics Code Authority came in 1954, 55, kind of, well, for one thing, it killed
to save
ECs.
America.
Yeah, right. But it brought back the superheroes for one thing. They were clean and safe. So the superheroes kind of resurged in the late 50s, early 60s. And I think it took a couple of decades for comics to be okay again.
How is the digital age impacting comics and comic books and comic book readers? It's impacted every print publication in the world. Are people, are kids wanting to read these things now off of Kindles and iPads, or do they want the paper?
Yes, it's all of the above. You know, us retailers were kind of scared to death when digital comics were starting to be offered. It's like, wow, who's going to come into a comic shop? But it's not the same experience. Having and holding and collecting a comic book is just different than reading it on a pad. Not that reading it on a pad's bad. And you know, you used to be able to buy comic books a lot of places. The pharmacy, the grocery store, the actual newsstand. I mean, where's a newsstand?
There are none.
Yeah, right. So it's hard to find a comic book outside of a comic shop. And that actually led to less people getting into comics because they weren't just running across them.
Digital is
the new newsstand.
I always wondered why you couldn't subscribe to the Superman comic books.
You could.
Have them mailed. You could?
Sure.
Would it be mailed to you?
It would. Yep.
Be darned.
You'd save about $1 a year on that $2 subscription or whatever.
We have about a minute left. Where do new comic book readers come from? Are they the progeny of old comic book readers, or do they just come to you fully grown?
Adult comic book fans turn their kids on to it for sure. Movies and TV cartoons and things like that are certainly making people aware.
Heroes Con at the Charlotte Convention Center, June 15th through 17th. We will be outside there at 9 o'clock on Friday with our local news roundup in costume, I'm told. Shelton Drum, thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.